Past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's interview comes from the Morning Show Archives. I know that any of you who are readers of the Racine Journal Times have surely noticed from time to time the beautiful writing of a friend of mine by the name of Carol Burrow Gianforte. And those of you who listen on Saturday mornings to WGTD may have heard a recently broadcast conversation which Linda Fleshinsky recorded with Carol about a beautifully crafted memoir which she has just released to the public called My Heart Leads Me Home, A Daughter's Memoir. In this book, Carol Gianforte looks back on her experience of growing up in the 1950s and 1960s in her parents' beautiful home on Carlisle Avenue in the heart of Racine. And the memoir is a look back at the life which they enjoyed together, Carol with her mother and father, some of the really interesting and fun relatives which would come to visit or they would go to visit, what it was like to grow up in that particular neighborhood and in the city of Racine back in those more innocent times. And this is a project which is a long time coming, that is this book. It's based in large measure on some of these lovely essays which have been published over the years in the Racine Journal Times. First of all, how long have you been a writer? I mean, even as someone, a young person growing up in Racine, was writing something that was important to you and something you were good at? Or is this a relatively recent addition to your life?
Well, Greg, I think this would be in the category of someone saying, I'm too old, I can't do that. Because I'm 67, and so this really began about 10 years ago. I sat down one night at a computer because I wanted to write a story about our next-door neighbors. That led to, you know, little by little, as you look at the picture, how the stories unfolded. I never thought of myself as a writer. I did term papers. I remember in sixth grade, I did a term paper on the city of Pompeii, wrote that out in penmanship. I wrote some term papers for my husband. And as I've said, I never got him above a B. So I did some writing as a teacher in public relations. But no, it was the night of sitting down to write a story about Philip and Jeanette, our next-door neighbors, which is an early story in the book.
And did anything in particular prompt that? I mean, was there some reason why you felt moved to sit down and write a story about them?
Isn't that strange? I really kind of wonder, in a metaphysical way, actually, if sometimes we have these prompts in our life. I should go down that street, or I should call that person. That's all I can say. Was it out of the clear blue or not? Certainly it was on my heart, but it was nothing that I had said for years, that is what I have to do.
And it was not any kind of professional assignment?
No.
It wasn't something that somebody else asked you to do?
No. Going back to the preface of the book, though, I guess the emotional part of this began when we closed up Carlisle Avenue in 1995. And I found, I can elaborate on this more maybe later, but I found that memories were a great, wonderful part of my life in connecting to my parents. It came as a miracle on what memories could do in my life.
And I know that repeatedly in the book you talk about how certain really great experiences that you have continue to give you really vivid pleasure even all these years later, and that sometimes maybe something kind that somebody did for you or something you did for somebody else mm-hmm. will be sort of this gift that keeps on giving because of the gift mm-hmm. of memory, which in a sense keeps it alive.
Mm-hmm. Coming back to Racine, too, we raised our daughter in West Bend, and we live a good deal of the time in Arizona. But deciding to come back to Racine 11 years ago, that plays a part in this, and it relates to your questioning about keeping the connections going. Because I can see my old neighbors, or they can mention others, and the networking seems to just becoming greater and greater, and a big part of that is appreciating what we've shared together. And yes, the specific instances that I can say, thank you, to remember this.
Hmm. So let's find out, first of all, a little bit about your parents in general. Then we'll dig into a couple of the specific stories that are in this book. And for those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Carol Baroji and 40 about her memoir, which is called My Heart Leads Me Home, A Daughter's Memoir. And this is primarily a story about the three of you, you and your mother and your father. I know that one of the things that's kind of an interesting characteristic of your parents and their marriage and your life together is that they were married relatively late in life, at least compared to what was commonplace back then. Mm-hmm. Just how late and did they find each other, and how did they find each other?
Okay, well, this is a central theme to my life. My mother had been a teacher, highly educated, went to St. Olaf College in 1920. She was born in 1903. And oh, how I hate these words today. She didn't really mention them, but old maid. Hmm. I'm using that word, and again, I don't like it at all. But she was considered an old maid.
That's how a lot of people would have seen her. I mean, and they might have admired her in many ways,
yes.
but a lot of people mm-hmm. would have made the assumption that she was yep. never going to get married.
And I do love the story in the book about cooking class, because it begins that she had 20 years of teaching experience when she married, but no cooking experience. But she was a very loved teacher in Fort Atkinson and did many things with her life. So I'd like to add that those years of her single life, she was so vibrant and appreciated and learned so much and had such a Christian faith. So she brought that to her marriage and her motherhood. Now, my father was much more scarred by the Depression, grew up in a farm area. Well, my mother grew up near Wisconsin Dells in a Norwegian area. My father grew up on a farm near Madison, a German community. He was the oldest and had to work in farm fields with horses. He was born in 1910, so he was 7 years younger. But they met when my father was in the city of Jefferson as a bookkeeper. My mother had just left the classroom after 10 years and was taking a new position down the road in Jefferson at the county seat. She was to supervise the teachers of the country schools of Jefferson County. So she bought a car and was learning how to drive, and they met in the Jefferson House, a fine boarding house. But the war was on, and would you believe they had a courtship of 5 to 7 years. So things did not move quickly in any way. But they came to Racine. My father was assigned by the government to oversee the closing of war records at the Massey Ferguson Company. By that time, my father was on track to be a CPA. And they came thinking it would be temporary. But they could see the wonderful advantages of business in Racine, and my father wanted to start his own CPA accounting business. But there's no doubt about it that they had spent those earlier years getting educations, worrying about the war, worrying about finances. And so they were very, very serious people.
Hmm.
And I mentioned the word serious a lot in the book. And guess who's serious today?
Right. Well, and you mentioned that you sometimes felt, I mean, for as much as you loved your parents and loved mm-hmm. that home and loved your family life, that once in a while you felt this a little bit of envy mm-hmm. when you looked at some of the other families on Carlisle Avenue that seemed more mm-hmm. lighthearted mm-hmm. than your own family
yes.
that seemed
yes.
so serious by comparison.
Right.
That it was a loving family,
yes.
but very serious.
Yes, we can emphasize that when they came to Racine and knew married life and then had me, surprisingly, just a year or two later, they had cultivated such work habits and faith, and they had done a lot with their lives. And I think they shared that with me, and they shared that with each other. We were really a team. But serious, yes. I've also talked about learning from this, that there's little quirks we have now as teenagers. How many times have we said to a parent or thought that they were embarrassing us, you know, when we were teenagers? And a theme of the book actually is my father's slow driving. Mm. People still come up to me in Racine. He's been gone 20 years. And will say, didn't he drive a green Pontiac? Mm. I remember him driving around town slowly. But to weed that all out and to know that I was so fortunate to have parents who respected me, who treated me with such respect and caring, that all that just goes by the wayside and is more amusing. Mm.
I know that one of the reasons they picked this particular home on Carlisle to purchase was because it was laid out in such a way that your father very easily could set aside space for an office. So that was really important, and that's this business that you mentioned was right in the home itself. So you were acutely aware this wasn't a job he did someplace else. It was right in the heart of your home and right in the heart of your family life.
I just wrote another story for the Journal Times that was in a couple weeks ago, Summer Jobs, but it really centered around the office in the home. And this book does have a picture of one scene of the office. My parents were in so many ways scarred by the Depression and frugal. So when they decided to buy, that was agony because they had to go into debt. Mm. And I'm quite certain that 1418 Carlisle cost them $13,000.
A lot of money back then, I suppose.
And maybe if it had been $5,000, they would have been worried. But yes, to have the office right there did make economic sense, and then it became a focal point of our lives. I wrote in the recent Racine story that I would go down Carlisle Avenue when I was maybe even 3 or 4 or 5, holding hands with my dad on a summer night to collect the records from State Street businesses that he was doing the books for. And then I would come back, and he would let me sort out all the Dolly Madison and Hostess Cupcake and everything receipts. So I was working at a young age in the business. Hmm. Also, the home allowed my parents to rent out the upstairs for quite a few years. And one of the stories, Mother Mary and Me, is about the very fortuitous experience I had in sixth grade when, really out of the blue, a teacher came and wanted to rent our upstairs, which had been closed to renters for some years. But after talking with my mother, lo and behold, she urged us to make the decision to let this teacher come. And Mary became such an instrumental person in my life in sixth grade as a role model, culminating with the fact that I was even in her wedding in spring, and I mean a 12-year-old girl in a wedding. But Mary and I are still in touch today. And so between the office and the home that endured for 45 years, but even the people that rented upstairs for a short time, big part of our lives.
Right, and gave you richer experiences than maybe you otherwise would have had. I want to ask you about something really specific. This comes in a chapter that we'll probably return to a little later, but or maybe we should talk about it now. It's the chapter where you talk about your family getting its first television. And one of the points you make in this chapter is that for quite a while, your family did not have television because your parents just saw no point in it. I mean, being such serious people. I think at one point you write, I understood that my parents would never believe in television. As kind and as generous as they were to me, they simply would not believe in wasting time watching a black and white box. And, of course, you looked at your neighbors who were very quick to get a TV as soon as they could and had to be just filled with envy, I'm sure, that they were enjoying something that you were not.
Yeah. So I think this chapter leads us actually to the heartwarming conclusion that families can work together. And even though my parents didn't like change, of course, the wonderful part of this for me is we eventually got a television. Now, it seemed like forever for me. But yes, I would go two houses down to my friend Jackie Olson's on Wednesday night to watch Walt Disney. And that was where we would sit on the floor, the three kids and the parents, in this probably very small flat that we didn't realize was small. And Walt Disney would speak to us and everything. But my parents, they didn't preach about it, but I just intuitively knew that there wouldn't be time for something like that. The business, the yard, the teachers upstairs, and reading. My mother was such a reader after being a teacher so long. So it came as the most wonderful surprise, when my dad and I took one of our frequent trips. That time it was just my dad with me. We went to Jefferson, his hometown. And innocently we were having a malt and a hamburger. And then he didn't walk back to the car. He walked in another direction. And I suppose today this was 12 feet wide, but we went to the Jefferson Radio and TV Clinic, and he said to the owner, "I think it's time we bought a television." And, you know, I'll never forget it. So that we did have a television, and I say in the book, believe it or not, my father never watched it. He didn't do it. He did not preach about it, like who would ever want to do that. He just kept on working, being somewhat of a workaholic. My mother would love the Billy Graham Crusades. She would break down the entire week of Billy Graham Crusades. And there were other few favorite programs, but they allowed me to watch, and I'm so thrilled that and thankful that they did.
Hmm. As you're describing this and the fact that your father, as far as you know, in those years he lived on Carlisle Avenue, never, ever watched television, ever at all, in helping us understand why he didn't, why he was not the least bit interested in watching television. At one point, you write then, he simply continued to work, which he had learned to do so effectively as a farm boy. Most likely, his life was filled with more drama than any television program could provide anyway. And you go on to say, and I want you to explain here, the way in which your father's life was filled with drama, because I think most of us imagine someone who's a certified public accountant has a life that's filled with anything but drama, but somehow he loved what he did, and there were aspects of it that really were just endlessly fascinating. Tell us more about that.
Well, Greg, I can't imagine anyone more thrilled with the details of their profession. He lived and breathed it. He was, of course, very dedicated to his clients. And it's fair to say that our dinner conversations were often filled with talking about the clients. And my mother and I never revealed anything. I have a good conscience about that. But if someone was not keeping their records the right way, or sometimes there were some bankruptcies. Another thing that would happen, to make this dramatic, but there were several times in my young life when someone came to him from a small business and said that they thought their partner was embezzling. And my father would make a plan after long discussions with this person. And in the evening, after business hours, my father and whoever that partner would have been would go to confiscate the books for the night. And my mother and I would be so nervous. But so he was concerned about the clients. But he loved the accounting itself. And frankly, you know, when we talk about the quirks, there are people that came to him and said, oh, you've taught me so much. But it was often a very delicate and somewhat embarrassing situation for my mother and me. Because, for instance, at relative gatherings, he would maybe be looking at his watch. As much as he did respect and want to be there, but he needed to get home to work. And, however, if the topic came around even remotely to income taxes or accounting, then he could stay and talk. So it was just a fascinating example of someone that he kept that passion his entire life.
For all those decades that he did that.
Entire life.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with a local writer by the name of Carol Barreau Gianforte. She grew up in Racine and has written a lovely memoir about her life growing up in a beautiful home on Carlisle Avenue, a memoir called My Heart Leads Me Home. And she shares all kinds of wonderful stories in this book about her family's life. One of the things you say about Carlisle Avenue, which is really interesting, and I'm glad that you include it, is the fact that although in many respects it was a very idyllic place to grow up with all kinds of other children in the neighborhood and beautiful places to explore, and when you were a youngster, the whole world was just Carlisle Avenue and the houses there and the yards and so on. But you do say that particularly early on, there were ways in which it was a lonely place to be. That there was a certain sort of icy reserve, maybe, about many of the neighbors in terms of when somebody new would come in. I think maybe you describe it as a neighborhood where very few people would ever leave. You just sort of stayed there forever. And so when there was a newcomer, they weren't, in a sense, easily welcomed with open arms. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate you including that, because I think a lot of us, when we reminisce about the past, often overlook that those kind of aspects to it, which are less than rosy. Tell us more about that, and if that ever changed to a significant extent.
Well, I'm glad to tell you that it certainly did change. But my parents, you know, bought the house with worries, $13,000 mortgage, and it needed work. And my father needed to keep the business progressing. But as I say in the book, Monday mornings, the women hung out the wash. And they would be calling to each other. But in those days, not to my mother. And then when people would pass by on the street, because even the oldsters would walk to Roma Lodge or the bank or down to Willie Kadrachi's store. If we happened to be outside, if my mother was working outside, the greetings at first, they were not there. So it did leave kind of a sorrowful worry as we began the years on Carlisle. But then my story about next-door neighbors Philip and Jeanette Weiler takes on even more meaning, and that's the first story that I ever wrote that I mentioned. Because the first owners were now needing to leave. My parents had bought from the first owner who would become aged. So the house next door was experiencing the same thing. And Philip and Jeanette Weiler moved in, who were younger than my parents, but what a wonderful bond, because they were so friendly, right next door.
And they were newcomers like you.
They were newcomers. And I say, when Philip and Jeanette left, which broke our hearts, maybe about 10 years later, the neighborhood by that time had grown together, and there was a potluck supper in a backyard for Philip and Jeanette leaving. So when you take it from the lonely first to the marking of Philip and Jeanette leaving, so many wonderful things then had happened.
I want you to mention one thing, one aspect of that friendship with those neighbors, which continued even after they moved to faraway Mesa, Arizona. And these were the phone calls that continued to be made on New Year's Eve. Tell us about those phone calls and about how long those continued.
Well, my father did not watch television, but my goodness, he did have people from his past, and my mother too, but I'm speaking of my father, who he would call them. He devoted time definitely to that. And so when the five of us, my parents, Philip and Jeanette, and me, had become such wonderful friends and they moved, my parents were really heartsick as I was. Well, we had gone to the Nelson Hotel, the five of us, at my father's and mother's invitation for several years on New Year's Eve. And it was exciting for me as a child because New Year's Eve, I mean, talk about mysterious. Mm. And these were prim and proper people who, frankly, were not rowdy in the least. The Nelson Hotel would just have nice white tablecloths and a hot beef dinner. And this was maybe happening late at night, but very quietly. So that became such a focal point on New Year's Eve. And so my father would call them in Arizona right around the right time toward New Year's Eve night. And that is the way we stayed in touch. There were typewritten letters. Jeanette was a great typist, and she would write. But those New Year's Eve calls kept us really together and learning about each other. And there were sorrows to come in Philip's and Jeanette's life, major sorrows. So when my father made the last call, it would have been in 1994, because he passed away prior to the next 1995. And I felt I had to continue it some way. So little, by hook or by crook, I did call them too and continued our friendship. And then the most wonderful, heartwarming thing was when my husband and I moved to Arizona. Certainly they were, yes, an hour away, but I could continue the friendship. And the book has a picture of Jeanette in an assisted living, and I'm sitting beside her, remembering the old days together.
Mm. And you have her, you quote her as saying at one point, as she looked back on a life that was filled with plenty of difficulties, "Life goes on, Carol. It does not stop for us in our sorrows." Mm-hmm. And that's probably an important bit of advice that a lot of people need to realize, that even when life assails us with things we wish didn't happen, it doesn't mean life stops and we can't stop either.
Greg, that was such a tremendous blessing of knowing Jeanette, because thank you for bringing that out. Yes, we sat and reminisced, but she became such an inspiration to me. As we really talked over, well, it had to do with a son that had died, and I'm not mentioning Philip because he had dementia at that time. So Jeanette her Bible was out on her bed, and she, every time I went to visit, the people were loving her, and she was attempting to have faith and move on. Very inspiring.
Hmm. And, of course, that whole story of being just the friends that your family needed at just the right time is really great, as was the sense that we get that you collectively maybe helped transform that neighborhood a bit, too, into a warmer and friendlier place. Another chapter that I especially love is actually the first chapter called Mother's American Home, in which you really describe the house in which you grew up on Carlisle Avenue and some of its idiosyncrasies and also its beauty. And at one point, you write this: "With its ownership, the challenge of furnishing the house began for Mother. There were not one but two adjoining living rooms. There was an imposing front entrance hall with heavy pocket doors. 30 windows needed her window treatments. Our home's beauty mattered greatly to her, as it would to many mothers. But in her case, there was one special reason. Mother was an artist. She appreciated beauty, and she needed to create it." That's probably my favorite paragraph in the whole book, just because I think that really helps us explain or helps us understand what sometimes is behind that. And, of course, there are some people who live in a house and never much care about those things and derive their satisfaction from other things. But for your mother, who was an artist, it was really important that her home was as beautiful as possible, even though your parents, needless to say, were on very much a limited income. And so your mother had to be very, very creative and innovative in the way she created that beauty. Tell us more about that.
Well, of course, the book explains how she borrowed some furniture, and I'm not going to give that away because that is the central surprise of that chapter,
right,
and her being chagrined at what had happened. But we would take my father to the North Shore early in the morning when I was quite young. He was doing some work in Milwaukee regularly. And I know when we would circle back toward Carlisle, she would pass Earl the Trader on State Street. And they were just starting out for the day. And if she could see a new lamp for her or a dresser or something, she would work very hard at trying to collect pieces from Earl the Trader. She was also at Racine Dry Goods a lot. I don't have a vivid memory of that store, but I know that she would go to this bin of fabric samples, upholstery samples. And she had a way of finding large swatches. There were a lot of floral things in the 50s. She also, believe it or not, she loved accent colors. And she would buy Turkish towels. And like maybe she loved coral, she loved aqua. And it sounds maybe a bit unappealing, but the way she used accent colors was really quite ingenious. And so she created in time, and then some new things. As I say, I have to say, I think every room was as beautiful as one could expect. Mm.
And I love the way you finish this chapter, too, when you talk about a lot of these furnishings and different items that were in your home that were beautiful, and many of which you have now in your home, I'm sure. You write, "But what I have come to see over the many years that have passed without her is that those furnishings, beautifully arranged as they became, were insignificant in and of themselves. Instead, they are the treasured reminders of the lovely person who collected them and of the precious life we three shared with the white Dutch colonial at 1418 Carlisle Avenue." I think that's a really good point, because I think some people don't stop to realize that, you know, well, why would you want to cart in all of this mm-hmm. stuff from your parents' house when you already have plenty mm-hmm. of stuff of your own? What a beautiful reason to have those things, to have them as tangible reminders of your mother and your father, for that matter. Can you think of one thing in particular in your home that is especially important to you mm-hmm. for this particular reason, that you look at this thing mm-hmm. and it reminds you
yes.
very vividly of your mom?
Yes, I do have one thing, Greg. And, oh my goodness, what it is, it's not a little pitcher or a little plate or a chair. Believe it or not, it's a baby grand piano. Now, my father being so frugal, he and my mother had bonded on the love of music. My father loved the clarinet and was in the Racine band for almost 40 years. My mother loved hymns and church music and playing piano. So I remember when I was, and I really don't have this emphasized in the book, but maybe I was 4 or 5, my father would look for ads for any kind of piano, a used piano. Hmm. And lo and behold, one summer day, here was a baby grand piano in West Racine. He took me on a Sunday after church, and it was a French provincial baby grand piano that the family just, elderly people, they were ready to let it go for a song. My father was overjoyed. We were all overjoyed. And I remember when it came, Merchant's Delivery delivered it in a big rainstorm, up the steps, flights of steps in the front of the house. And it sat for many, you know, so right in the bay window. Now, I have that in our condo here in Racine today. And I am not musical. That's another wonderful gift that my parents gave me, the gift of understanding. I didn't have their gifts for music, but I have the family piano. And what am I going to do with it? Well, I think our daughter someday will take it. Hmm. But that's a pretty dramatic piece of a family memory. But I just know how that centered in our family life and how my father was so unbelievably thrilled that it was so inexpensive.
Hmm. We're speaking with Carol Borrow-Gianforte about her memoir called My Heart Leads Me Home, A Daughter's Memoir. Another interesting thing you say at one point about the house specifically is that your father was perpetually trying to maintain the house. I mean, obviously they'd poured a lot of money into it and it was important to them, so they tried to keep it in as good a shape as they possibly could. You write, "Our front porch received the most attention from my father. Oh, he was far too busy building his accounting business to sit on it on a summer evening. That never happened once in the 45 years he lived at 1418 Carlisle, but it was a frequent subject at our dinner table. If there was time left over after his accounting stories of the day told dramatically to Mother and to me, my father watched every inch of that front porch with an eagle eye to keep it in perfect condition. Under his direction, it was frequently being scraped and hand-painted, swept, or washed." So why was it that your front porch was so important to your father if he never sat on that front porch?
Greg, now you're making me think. I really don't have an answer to that. Was it that it was the front of the home and the first impression? Because he was equally concerned with the garage and so forth. But maybe it was the first impression. But it did lead to some fine memories for me of workmen that would come. And this is not in the book, but I wonder if listeners might know this name. My father thought that a carpenter, and I'm pretty sure the name was Frank Lorenz, was just a marvelous carpenter. And I'm pretty sure it was Mr. Lorenz that would replace boards and work on the spindles. And at least one time, my father took me to see Mr. Lorenz, not far away on the north side. And they had me go to their backyard. Again, maybe I was 5 years old. And there Mr. Lorenz had built for his children or grandchildren the biggest playhouse, like a Magic Kingdom playhouse that you could imagine, being a carpenter. So I still drive down that street sometimes and wonder, I'm going to stop someday. I'm going to look up the address from a phone book and see if the folks know that the most wonderful playhouse in the world was in that backyard.
I like that. One of the things that your book talks about at one point, you've mentioned this very briefly, is that your mother, for all of her gifts, was at least early on not an especially skilled cook, or at least not an experienced one. For all of the rich experiences she had as a working woman in the years before she married your dad, she had virtually no experience as a cook. And I think you write very movingly about her efforts to become a better cook and of how important it was to her for her to do that well. In fact, I really think it's interesting that when you talk about the one thing she could always do well was make a meal look good in terms of presentation. But when it came to actually preparing the food, that was something else. Mm-hmm. Tell our listeners more about that.
Well, I still have a wonderful, huge set of Fiesta dishes that she received for a bridal shower. Because, as I say, people were so shocked that this person, Ann Fadness, was going to be married, that they were overjoyed and gave so many things that she always treasured. So with her artistic ability, she had these wonderful wedding gifts. And no matter how tired or busy she was, and the Maytag wringer washer in the basement, we always had cloth napkins, beautiful flowers on the table. Not because she was showing off. It was the artist, the creating a scene. But the food, yes, the food. Now, she was concerned about eating well. I think we were talking about the 7 food groups or something back then.
Mm.
So she was vegetables and so forth. She had a garden. She wanted us to eat properly. But really preparing the food. So I have to say, how would she feel if she heard me say this today? Maybe she is hearing me say this today. But she would fry things way too long.
Mm.
And once in a while, she would cry over a recipe that completely had failed. What I could never understand was how she was brave enough to use a pressure cooker. And if you know what that is, I mean, that would be steaming and hissing. It served its purpose, though, because we had a lot of boiled dinners where you put everything in at once. But you would hear about people's pressure cookers exploding. And she didn't have a lot of practice with that. However, over time, as I say in the story, she developed just a set of wonderful recipes, maybe not that many. But, you know, and she loved the strawberry shortcake she would make. I loved them. A date tort cake she perfected. But she did avoid big meals for the relatives. And that's part of the story where she did not want to cook like a turkey for Thanksgiving because of her fears.
You write, for the 45 years of her married life, Mother never did prepare a Thanksgiving turkey at all. I mean, even just a normal meal would present grave challenges to her, and let alone, you know, a major sort of undertaking. And it's just sort of interesting because you think about someone who was in so many ways perfectly capable, intelligent, well-educated. Yes. But this was, in a sense, an unfamiliar arena for her.
And, Greg, you know, I think that this is for people who have already written or are thinking of writing. This was a difficult story to write, even though it's one of my favorites. And people who don't cook have come up to me and said, oh, I love your mother, because I never made a turkey either. But to write about a foible like that, and not have people think she was a buffoon or too, you know, that was not really the point of it. It was a legitimate fear that held her back. But to balance that out with how wonderful she was, that was quite tricky to write.
Yeah, I'm glad you did that, though, because it gives the book some extra texture and reminds us, too, that I think a lot of us, when we think back to, for instance, the 1950s, we just sort of imagine, we tend to paint with a very broad brush and imagine that every single woman spent all of her time in the kitchen and was perfectly accomplished and confident and maybe knew very little about the rest of the world, but boy, they sure knew every inch of their kitchen and knew their recipes backwards and forwards. And your story reminds us that it was a complicated time, and that for somebody like your mother, a perfectly loving, dutiful, devoted wife and mother, being a good cook was just not part of her story, or not for a long time anyway. I want you to say a brief word about, out of time actually, but the fact that your story is not only about growing up in Racine in a life that was very much anchored to a particular neighborhood, but also that it was a life that occasionally meant a road trip here and there, and particularly some trips to what amounted to the family farm. And that sometimes from very vast distances, certain relatives would come, like a certain uncle who would come all the way from Montana, who lived a life that you could scarcely imagine. And I think that's really an interesting ingredient in your story as well, that it is a story about being anchored solidly, and yet it is this story also about getting glimpses of the outside world and about and getting a glimpse at lives very different from your own.
Well, I'm very, very appreciative today. Here I am in my late 60s, and I can still remember the farm life of Wisconsin, and I still can talk to cousins about days we spent together on the farm, maybe only a dozen in all. And they come alive. That's our bond. But I want to say, Greg, briefly, that my parents did always think about moving to the Jefferson area toward retirement, which never happened and so forth. But the Jefferson area, my father's hometown. And I was okay with that. And it never even came close, though. But the fact that they made such room for both of their hometowns and their families and former friends, you know, I think that's one reason why my husband and I are back in Racine. Because I grew up with an example of valuing a hometown. And perhaps if I had grown up in just the opposite, which is okay, but you never go home again, maybe it wouldn't have been such a force in our lives to come back to Racine.
Hmm.
So here we are in our hometown, my husband John and me.
Hmm. And with this book, you have brought so many of these really important chapters in your earlier life back to life. Just say a quick word about the experience of sitting down and writing about some of these things. Are these memories sort of always there vividly, or do you find that as you sit down mm-hmm. to write about them, that mm-hmm. just the act of writing, in a sense, brings these memories a little more potently into view?
Well, that is certainly the case. I'll have an idea in mind, like, let's say, the television. But the more I started to write that, then I could remember the television shows. I could remember how it looked. I could remember going to the neighbors. So I think maybe that deepens and broadens the memories. The stories have been relatively easy to write as a draft. But then to really make them flow and present the real meaning that I want. I hope the meanings that I'm presenting are really gentle, but like the story about my mother's cooking, it was easy to write in the draft, but how was I really going to convey to people a true picture of her? The one about the American home and the furniture, it did need to lead to what she would want and what I would want, that furnishings in and of themselves are just a symbol of someone. So they're easy to write, and then they're harder as you polish them and as you remember more.
Well, you've really done a beautiful job of putting this memoir together. I am quite impressed and enjoyed the book very much. We want to remind our listeners that the book is My Heart Leads Me Home, A Daughter's Memoir. Carol Barogian, 40, I'm glad we got to do this. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Greg. It was just a pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, my conversation with best-selling author Jacqueline Tobin, talking about her book From Midnight to Dawn, The Last Tracks of the Underground Railroad. The book tells the intriguing story not only of the Underground Railroad, but of that last leg of the journey for many slaves escaping captivity for freedom, whose journeys would often take them to the northern border of the United States and into Canada. On Monday, in its entirety, you'll hear an interview that I excerpted yesterday on The Morning Show with Jacqueline Pritchett, who has a really extraordinary story. She grew up in Kenosha, but in abject poverty, in fact, spending long portions of her childhood essentially homeless, and for many years pretty much acting as the parent of the family when her single mother was unable to shoulder such responsibilities. She has gone on to graduate from Carthage and is soon to be certified as a psychologist, hoping to set up private practice here in Kenosha. And she's going to be speaking at the Civil War Museum as part of their Courageous Conversation series. That presentation is going to be on Tuesday evening, but in the meantime, you can hear her full story in its entirety on Monday's Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org and available as a podcast on all the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast, 7 days a week. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. You're listening to WGTD FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. We're approaching 9.